This is VOA News. Reporting via remote, I'm Richard Green. The United States on Wednesday accused Moscow of committing a war crime by forcibly deporting Ukrainians to Russia and said it has information Russian officials are overseeing so-called filtration operations. Linda Thomas Greenfield, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, told the U.N. Security Council she estimates authorities have interrogated, detained, and forcibly deported between 900,000 and 1.6 million Ukrainians to Russia following the Russian invasion in late February. Thomas Greenfield said in July alone, Washington had information that more than 1,800 children were transferred from Russia-controlled areas of Ukraine to Russia. Russia's UN ambassador denied the accusations, calling the meeting a waste of time. A Canadian official says the final suspect in a stabbing rampage is dead at his own hand. AP correspondent Mike Gracia reports.
32-year-old Miles Sanderson, the final suspect in a deadly stabbing rampage in Canada, died of self-inflicted wounds Wednesday after his car was run off the road by police, according to an official who spoke on condition of anonymity. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police said Sanderson was tracked down near the town of Rothsern, Saskatchewan, after police received a report of a stolen vehicle being driven by a man armed with a knife. Sanderson had been the subject of a three-day manhunt following the weekend stabbings in which 10 people were killed. On Monday, authorities had discovered the body of the other suspect, Sanderson's brother, 30-year-old Damian Sanderson. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police are investigating if Miles Sanderson killed his brother. I'm Mike Gracia.
Officials in the Philippines say President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. has approved a recommendation to end the mandatory wearing a mask outdoors across the country more than 2 years after it was imposed at the height of the coronavirus pandemic. This is VOA News. The Interior Secretary says the Philippines and Myanmar are the last countries in Southeast Asia to ease the compulsory wearing of masks outdoors, though he encouraged the elderly and those with other illnesses to continue masking up in public areas. Among the hardest hit by coronavirus outbreaks in Southeast Asia, the Philippines imposed one of the largest lockdowns in the world, which caused its worst economic recession in decades and deepened poverty, hunger, and unemployment. Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro has transformed the nation's bicentennial into a multi-city campaign event amid concerns from critics he would use his appearances to undermine the upcoming election. The incumbent president drew tens of thousands of staunch supporters for rallies in Brasilia, Rio de Janeiro, and Sao Paulo. The armed forces put on military displays in the first two cities. Bolsonaro compared his opponent, former President Lula da Silva, to autocratic leftist leaders in Venezuela and Nicaragua and called him a gangster. Bolsonaro trails da Silva in polls before the October 2nd vote. Survivors of one U.S. school shooting are sending a message of hope to survivors of another. The AP's Ed Donahue reports.
Ashley Huebner was in second grade when 20 children and six educators were shot and killed at her school, Sandy Hook. She feels a lot of emotions, anger, anxiety, and survivor's guilt.
I'm wasting that because they could have had this amazing life and they could have not taken this for granted and just survived to do so many better things than I'm doing.
Huebner knows what is ahead for the students in Uvalde.
It's been 9 years since Sandy Hook. We had 9 years for this to not happen again, and yet it did. And now these kids are going to have to go through the same exact thing. I mean, that's just, like, heartbreaking.
Jackie Hegarty was also in second grade at Sandy Hook. Her advice to the kids in Uvalde?
Don't bottle things up. You know, talk to your family, your friends, because it's so important to talk this stuff through.
Her other message to them, it will get better. I'm Ed Donahue.
Recapping our top story. The United States on Wednesday accused Moscow of committing a war crime by forcibly deporting Ukrainians to Russia and said it has information Russian officials are overseeing so-called filtration operations. Linda Thomas Greenfield, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, told the U.N. Security Council she estimates authorities have interrogated, detained, and forcibly deported between 900,000 and 1.6 million Ukrainians to Russia following the Russian invasion in late February. Thomas Greenfield said in July alone, Washington had information that more than 1,800 children were transferred from Russian-controlled areas of Ukraine to Russia. Russia's UN ambassador denied the accusations, calling the meeting a waste of time. Reporting via remote, I'm Richard Green for VOA News.
Today is Thursday, September 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, shelling resumes near Ukraine's huge nuclear power plant as the U.S. successfully tests an ICBM.
U.S. officials are trying to separate this test from the conflict and the tensions in Ukraine and also the tensions in East Asia and the Pacific.
Human rights groups accuse China of arbitrarily detaining 1 to 2 million Muslim minorities.
In 2020, the Australian Strategic Policy Institute identified more than 380 suspected detention facilities in Xinjiang. In August, China said these were lies.
And dozens are dead from an earthquake in western China. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Shelling has resumed in the area of Ukraine's huge nuclear power plant. Russian and Ukrainian officials blame each other. The attack Wednesday comes a day after the UN Atomic Watchdog Agency pressed for the warring sites to carve out a safe zone to protect against a possible catastrophe. A Ukrainian regional governor said Russians fired on a city on the opposite bank of the Dnieper River from Europe's largest nuclear power plant. Russian authorities said the city where the power plant is located is in a blackout because Ukrainian shelling had damaged a power substation. The fighting near the plant has caused international alarm amid fears of a nuclear catastrophe. Russia denies that it is housing military equipment at the Zaporizhia nuclear plant in Ukraine, Europe's largest atomic power station. Inspectors from the United Nations nuclear watchdog, the International Atomic Energy Agency, published their report Tuesday calling for a zero zone to be put in place around the plant following months of shelling that has damaged parts of the facility. As Henry Ridgewell reports, Ukraine says the IAEA report doesn't go far enough.
Inna Holikova is preparing for a nuclear disaster. She's collecting medicines for herself and her 2-year-old son, Alexander, to counter any radiation leak from the nearby Zaporizhia nuclear plant.
I came here to get the iodine potassium pills, so if there is a catastrophe, we will be able to take it and save our lives. I hope we won't need it.
IAEA inspectors Tuesday reported extensive damage to the plant, including to a building that houses fresh nuclear fuel and radioactive waste. The inspectors were forced to take cover from nearby shelling during their visit. UN's Secretary General called for a protection zone around the site.
That would include a commitment by Russian forces to withdraw all military personnel and equipment from that perimeter, and the commitment by Ukrainian forces not to move into it.
IAEA inspectors witnessed Russian military personnel and equipment at the site, including military trucks stationed in 2 turbine halls. Ukraine says Russia is shelling the area as part of a false flag operation. Russia on Wednesday denied military equipment is stored there and blamed Ukraine for the attacks. The main grid power lines to the site are damaged. Its cooling systems are currently powered by a backup line from the plant's generator itself. Diesel generators are a last resort. A total loss of power would force a shutdown of the reactor cooling system. Ukraine's government says it is exploring whether the plant can be shut down. Currently, only one of the plant's 6 reactors is operating. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The U.S. has successfully test-fired an ICBM in a show of nuclear readiness. The missile test comes as concerns over nuclear security amid Russia's war in Ukraine and frosty relations with the West. Russian President Vladimir Putin placed his nuclear forces on the alert few weeks into the invasion and threatened to resort to nuclear escalation if the U.S. becomes more involved in the war. This as the Kremlin moves to purchase artillery and arms from North Korea to replenish its depleted stock. For more, I spoke with VOA's national security correspondent, Jeff Seldon.
U.S. officials are being very careful to emphasize there's nothing more to read into this and trying to separate this test of an ICBM from the conflict and the tensions both in Ukraine with the Russian invasion of Ukraine and also the tensions existing in East Asia and the Pacific with some of the tensions that have been rising between China and Taiwan.
The intercontinental ballistic missile is both defensive and an offensive weapon, is it not?
intercontinental ballistic missile. It can carry a nuclear warhead. It is part of the U.S. nuclear triad and part of the U.S. defense, the U.S. homeland. It's part of the defense that plays into the defense and strategies to defend U.S. allies. So it's something that the U.S. maintains and tests routinely, according to the Pentagon. Again, there's been a lot of saber rattling across the world, especially in North Korea does it periodically. There's been some saber rattling, analysts would say, experts would say, from China, where they've been growing their nuclear arsenal. And of course, Russia has threatened to possibly use its nuclear weapons due to the conflict in Ukraine, depending on how events turn out. Rhetoric that the U.S. has called massively irresponsible. Any test launch, no matter how routine, does cause a lot of tensions. The U.S. has been doing what it can, according to officials, to signal that there is no saber rattling here. There are no other messages being sent. And test, in this case, is just a test.
Talking about the Ukraine conflict, there are reports that Russia is trying to replenish its stock by turning to North Korea for artillery and ammunition to prosecute the continuing invasion of Ukraine.
There was a U.S. intelligence assessment earlier this week that came out and determined that Russia had indeed reached out to Pyongyang trying to find out about artillery shells, munitions, that it might be able to acquire. The Pentagon this week confirmed that. U.S. officials in the military community and the intelligence community say this is just an indication of how thinly stretched Russia's forces are now, as its invasion of Ukraine has dragged on for more than half a year. It was supposed to take days, maybe weeks at most. Clearly, Russia has met more than it bargained for in the Ukrainian forces, with the Ukrainian forces being backed and bolstered by NATO and Western countries, including the U.S. Remember, it wasn't so long ago that the U.S. intelligence committee also concluded and said that it appears that Russia had reached out and had actually bargained and purchased from Iran Iranian-made drones to use in the conflict. U.S. and other Western allies say it's a sign that Russia is in trouble and that Russian forces do not have what they need to continue to hold ground or advance.
That's VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Seldon speaking with me from Washington, D.C. Human rights groups have accused China of arbitrarily detaining 1 to 2 million Muslim minorities in the Xinjiang region of the country, actions these organizations have described as crimes against humanity. One Uyghur woman who experienced what life was like in detention shared her story with VOA. Elizabeth Lee narrates the story for reporter Xiao Yu in Paris.
Gilbahar Hetwaji spent nearly 3 years inside what she calls a Chinese re-education camp.
I was chained to the bed. We couldn't defecate during 10 days. And when I did it for the first time, I was attached like a dog and I had to do it in front of everybody. So I cried at that time.
Hetwaji wrote a memoir about her experience that's been translated into several languages. She is speaking in her native tongue. The voice in English is that of her daughter, Yilhumar Hetwaji, who is translating for her. Originally from Xinjiang, Hetwaji was an engineer in China before moving to France with her daughters in 2006.
In end November 2016, I received a call from my company in Karamay, and they asked me to go back to make the anticipated retirement process. I never suspected anything because I never did anything wrong and against China in France.
She says the call was a trap and that Chinese police accused her family of being terrorists.
Every time we go to interrogation session, they put black bag on our head. Our ankles are constantly chained, and I've been attached 20 days.
After being detained for 4 months, Hetwaji received notice that she would be transferred to a school.
Every Friday was test days. They told us we have to succeed everything because otherwise we will stay there forever.
Through its state news agency Xinhua, China described the schools as vocational education and training centers. Xinhua said that the centers aimed to de-radicalize the trainees and that all had graduated by October 2019.
China is lying, definitely, because they're still opening new camps.
Scholars and human rights groups have accused Beijing of detaining 1 million to 2 million Uyghurs and other Muslim minorities in Xinjiang.
In 2020, the Australian Strategic Policy Institute identified more than 380 suspected detention facilities in Xinjiang. In August, China said these were lies.
They are using human rights as a pretext to undermine Xinjiang's prosperity and stability and contain China's development and revitalization.
Hetwaji says with the help of family and the French government, she was released and returned to Paris in August 2019.
People in China can't speak out about the camps because if they do, they will get back inside the camps.
The press office in Xinjiang denied that Hetwaji was tortured. Hetwaji has had no contact with her family in Xinjiang since the publication of her memoir. For Xiaoyu in Paris, Elizabeth Lee, VOA News.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Liz Truss officially became Prime Minister of Britain, replacing Boris Johnson, who announced his resignation in July. As Henry Joel again reports from London, Truss is seen as a foreign policy hawk and had pledged a tough line against Russia and China, but she faces daunting challenges at home.
Changeover day in Britain, a country rarely short on ceremony and tradition. Outgoing Prime Minister Boris Johnson met Queen Elizabeth II Tuesday to offer his resignation at her Scotland residence. The 96-year-old monarch is unable to travel to London because of health problems. Just a few hours later, Liz Truss made the same journey and was asked by the Queen to form a new government. She is the 15th Prime Minister to be appointed by Elizabeth. Truss flew back to London and gave a televised address.
We now face severe global headwinds caused by Russia's appalling war in Ukraine and the aftermath of COVID. United with our allies, we will stand up for freedom and democracy around the world.
Any political honeymoon will likely be short-lived, says John Kampfner of Chatham House.
90% of her time is going to have to be dealing with the here and now on the domestic agenda with an economy in crisis, strikes, health service, huge energy bills, potential for social unrest.
Despite a promise to cut taxes, it's reported that Truss will spend up to $150 billion on freezing energy bills. She has pledged to boost defence spending to 3% of GDP, estimated to cost $180 billion. Meanwhile, she has pledged to continue giving military and humanitarian aid to Ukraine. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky welcomed her appointment. In Ukraine, we know her well, he said in a video posted online. She was always on the enlightened side of European politics. I believe that together we will be able to do much more for the protection of our nations and to ensure the failure of Russia's destructive efforts, he said. As a government minister, Truss took a hawkish stance on China. Neil Melvin is from the Royal United Services Institute.
So China will be recognised under her premiership, she's indicated, as a threat to the UK.
Truss has also pledged to tear up a key Brexit agreement that Johnson signed with the European Union over Northern Ireland. Again, John Kampfner of Chatham House.
The worst case scenario is a full-blooded trade war between the 27 European nations and Britain. In every respect, that will be a disaster. It will add fuel onto the fire of an already pretty terrible UK economy.
President Biden congratulated Truss on Twitter, saying he looked forward to deepening the special relationship with Britain. Again, John Kampfner of Chatham House.
But the Americans, and particularly the Biden administration, are incredibly wary of having to choose between the Brits and the European Union. They regard it as a false choice.
Analysts say rarely has a new prime minister faced so many headwinds on taking office. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Pakistan's Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif said on Wednesday that parts of the country seemed like, quote, like a sea, unquote, after visiting some of the flood-hit areas that cover as much as a third of the South Asian nation. Rachel Graham of Reuters reports.
Only about 900 of more than 100,000 pregnant women displaced by the ongoing and massive floods across Pakistan's Sindh province have made it to relief camps. according to data from the provincial government released on Tuesday, and it's raising fears of births in harrowing conditions. The record monsoon rains and melting glaciers in Pakistan's northern mountains have brought floods that have affected 33 million people and killed more than 1,300, including 458 children. About a third of the country has been hit. The relief effort is a huge burden for an economy already needing help from the International Monetary Fund. This is the civil hospital Dadu of Dadu City, which says it has been overwhelmed with more than 72,000 patients in recent days. Pediatrician Dr. Ala Bakskareja has been among the team treating some 5,000 children with diarrhea.
Because of the rains, the cases of diarrhea, malaria and gastric illnesses have increased in Dadu district. We are admitting around 100 cases of diarrhea and around 5 to 6 cases of malaria every day. The uptick in diarrhea is because of the accumulation of dirty water.
The United Nations has called for $160 million in aid to help the flood victims, but Finance Minister Miftah Ismail said the damage was far higher, telling the US news network CNBC that the total was closer to $10 billion, if not more.
That's Richard Graham of Reuters. In other news, the death toll in the earthquake in western China has jumped to 74, with 26 people still missing. At the same time, frustration is rising with uncompromising COVID-19 lockdown measures that prevented residents from leaving their buildings after Monday's 6.8 magnitude quake in Sichuan province. It caused extensive damage to homes in the Gansu Tibetan Autonomous Region and shook buildings in the provincial capital of Chengdu, whose 21 million citizens are under a strict COVID-19 lockdown. Authorities refused to allow anxious residents of apartment buildings out, adding to public anger over the strict zero-COVID policy mandating lockdowns, quarantines and other restrictions, even while the rest of the world has largely reopened. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com and check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition and our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Mozambique's president says Islamist militants in the country's northern Nampula province have killed 6 people, all by beheading, and abducted 3 others. The Islamist militant group in northern Mozambique is spreading to new territory despite efforts by government and regional forces to contain it, as Charles Manguero reports from Maputo.
Speaking live on national radio Wednesday from the southern Gaza province, President Filipe Jacinto Nyusi confirmed the beheadings and abductions and said dozens of houses were set on fire on Tuesday. This was the third terrorist attack within 5 days in Nampula province, where the residents are creating a new wave of displaced people, though authorities do not have exact numbers. The president said the militants were attempting to bolster their numbers.
Nos últimos dias desceram para a província de Nampula.
He said, in the last days, they descended to the Nampula province, where they tried to recruit new members for their ranks, but without being successful in transferring these youth, hence their nervousness. They are very nervous. On Friday night, militants attacked the village of Kutuwa in the district of Ferati. On Sunday, they attacked the village of Nyaminyanya, also in the member district. In his speech, Nyusi said Mozambique's defense forces, with the support of troops from Rwanda and the regional bloc SADC, are fighting the militants. The president said Mozambican forces recently recaptured a terrorist base.
As forças de defesa e segurança tomaram...
He said defense and security forces took over Katuma base in Akwabe district in Kabelgado province, a terrorist base, a place where terrorists had taken refuge after being displaced in towns and villages now under the responsibility of government authorities. News added that finding the militants is difficult because many are hiding out in a dense forest. With the worsening of the terrorist wave in Cabo Delgado in recent years, Many residents have fled to Nampula, looking for a safe and peaceful place to live. Nampula is now the third province of northern Mozambique where terrorist attacks have displaced villagers following Cabo Delgado and Niassa. Charles Mangwiro for VOA News, Maputo, Mozambique.
This is Science in a Minute.
Researchers at New York Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai have released a new study that proposes astronauts have a higher risk of developing mutations in their DNA that can increase their risk of developing cancer and heart disease sometime during their lifetimes. The study also suggests that the mutations may possibly be associated with spaceflight. The researchers collected blood samples from 14 NASA astronauts who flew in space shuttle missions between 1998 and 2001. Upon examining the blood samples, the researchers say they found DNA mutations, called somatic mutations, in the blood-forming systems of the astronauts. The researchers define somatic mutations as those that take place in cells other than sperm or egg cells after an individual is conceived, meaning that the mutations cannot be passed on to their children. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and our panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including a federal judge granted former President Donald Trump's request to appoint a special master to review materials that were seized by the FBI during its search of his Mar-a-Lago residence on August 8th. We'll examine this and more on Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. And check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition and our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinodofo in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The State Department has barred Paraguay and Vice President Hugo Velasquez from entering the United States due to his involvement in significant corruption, including bribery of a public official and interference in public processes, said Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Vice President Velasquez announced his resignation from office and will no longer run for president in the next election. The United States also designated Yacyretá Binational Entity Legal Counsel Juan Carlos Charlie Duarte for involvement in significant corruption. Duarte, a close personal and professional associate of Vice President Velasquez, offered a bribe to a Paraguayan public official in order to obstruct an investigation that threatened the vice president and his financial interests, explained Secretary Blinken in a statement. Corrupt acts such as these also contribute to diminished confidence in the government and public perceptions of corruption and impunity within the office of the Paraguayan vice president, he added. Moreover, Duarte's act of corruption abused and exploited his privileged public position within the Yacyretá binational entity, risking public confidence in one of Paraguay's most vital economic assets. Duarte has since been removed from his post at Yacyretá, said Paraguayan President Mario Abdo Benitez. The U.S. Department of State also designated Velasquez's immediate family members as ineligible to enter the United States, including Lourdes Maria Andrea Samaniego Gonzalez, Dionisio Adalberto Velasquez Jimenez, Sonia Rebecca Velasquez Esquariza, and Hugo José Velasquez Esquariza, and Duarte's immediate family members, including Ninfa Concepcion Vera Morera and Tamara Duarte Martinez. These designations reaffirm the commitment of the United States to combat corruption, which harms the public interest, hampers countries' economic prosperity, and curtails the ability of governments to respond effectively to the needs of their people. The United States continues to stand with all Paraguayans in support of democracy and the rule of law, and will continue to promote accountability for those who abuse public power for personal gain, regardless of their position or political affiliation.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.